chapter 2, where Don read to us a minute ago. We come to the end of this chapter, message number 10 in our walk through the book of Philippians. And I've titled this Workers in Salvation, and this has to do with a man named Epaphroditus, you see in verse 25. Back in verse 12, we were told to work out our own salvation in verse 13, because it is God that works in us. And so as we are working out the salvation that has been worked inside us by God, here are two co-workers, you might say. Paul designates these two men, Timothy, verse 19, and Epaphroditus, verse 25, as co-workers and fellow soldiers and laborers together with this process of God working in us to will and to do His good pleasure. The name Epaphroditus is interesting. We only have it here in the Bible, twice mentioned in this book. And if you look at this name, you will see something about it. If you take off the E and the P at the first of the name, what do you have left? You have the reference to a god, small g, Aphrodite. And Aphrodite in Greek was the Venus in the Roman mythology, a stumbling block to believers in the first century, especially in Corinth and in other places, as a lewd type of worship was offered to her. And we still refer to someone like that as an aphrodisiac from her name. Well, what it would mean, of course, is that this man was born into a pagan and lost family, which was very typical in the first century, before they heard the gospel, before they knew the good news of Jesus Christ. And so when children were born, you gave them a name, and this name means belonging to Aphrodite. And many children had those kinds of names, and they grew up in that culture. Then at some place, some time in his life, he heard the gospel, was gloriously saved and became a believer, though he still would bear this old name. Venus, you know, in the Roman mythology, Venus and Cupid, like Baal and Ashtoreth in the Phoenician mythology, refers to that star, you know, the bright star in the light. We still see it now in the late fall. But isn't it good that Jesus is the bright and morning star, and He can take someone named after the old morning star and give him a name which is a new name after the bright and morning star, which He did. And gloriously saved this young man. We take him as a young man, probably kind of like Timothy. And again, I say he's mentioned here in chapter 4, verse 18, in those two places only. So not in the book of Acts or in any of the other epistles do we have any other reference to him. The only thing we seem to know is that he was from Philippi. This was his church, and he had come to Rome to minister to Paul and for him, and he became severely sick and had to return home, and Paul sending him back home. There's a man named Epaphras in the book of Colossae, and it is true that Epaphras is kind of a shortened name for the name Epaphroditus, like you have Timotheus and Timothy, and we have a lot of shortened names that way. But this doesn't seem to be the same person as is mentioned to the letter in Colossae. That seems to be someone who is from Colossae and someone entirely different. So two people by a very similar name, but Paul distinguishes them by using the longer name here and the shorter name to the other man. Well, I think this passage, 25 through 30 of this chapter, is very unique, and it's unique for this reason. We have here the consequences of a young man taking a short missions trip to see the missionary and not being able to stay very long and having to rush home. And I think that's a unique thing, because we send out missionaries, and while those missionaries are on the field, we try to do various things for them, including going to see them ourselves. And sometimes prospective missionaries go and see other missionaries, sometimes just lay people trying to help them, sometimes pastors go to see their missionaries on the field. And here we have just kind of a unique passage of what happened to a young man as he did that and went to Rome and kind of had to exit early. And I think we can learn some things about it. And so my thoughts and my speaking this morning is kind of directed toward that kind of a mission endeavor, specifically kind of a mission trip that he took. Now, in our lifetime, in our generation, mission trips have proliferated. I mean, there are many more of these now than there used to be, of course, because travel is much easier now, and even funds can be raised and are available. Whereas years ago, William Carey in the late 1700s went to India, but he stayed the rest of it. He never came home because it was about a year's round-trip journey, a half a month back and a half a month to get on the field. You just don't waste time like that. So they didn't travel much in the old days, but in the 20th century, it's become a lot easier. Of course, I remember stories of the older missionaries that I remember hearing when I was a boy, maybe you do too, when they would get on a ship, and they would sail to a continent on board a ship and make their journey to where they were going. It was a long process to do. And then time went on, and nowadays, of course, you can take a mission trip literally to the other side of the world, do your work, and be back home within 7 days and do the whole thing. And I'm glad, personally, for the missionary's sake, that travel is easier, because there are those times when it is dangerous for them, or illnesses come to them and they need the medical care they can only get here, or maybe there's a tragedy that happens in the family or something like that. I'm glad that they can return easily and then get back to the field, and it isn't a year-long round trip as it used to be. Well, because of that, we all the time hear about groups of young people or a church group or whatever going to a field to do some work with the missionary and come back. And I think we'll see in this passage that there are always kind of pros and cons in doing that kind of thing. As a matter of fact, let me give you a few. One of the pros in doing it is it's a great exposure for anyone who goes to a mission field, and especially young people who might be seeking God's will in their life in regards to missions or regard to that kind of work, to be able to go there and be on the field and live with a missionary for a while and see what he does and kind of sit where they sit. And a lot of times, that's an answer to somebody. Maybe God says no, maybe God says yes. But there's that kind of benefit, and that's one of the reasons why churches and schools and all take trips with young people to a mission field so they can see if God isn't working on them. Also, there's the temporary help that it provides to a missionary, especially if it's something that this group of people can come and put their hands on right away, build something, fix something, or maybe even, of course, evangelism. And evangelism is always a great ministry to whoever's doing it. Whether Americans going to a foreign country, helping the missionary, or those people over there who hear the gospel. If somebody's saved because of it, praise the Lord. Now, and also then there are some cons, some detriments in our day and age. One is there's no doubt that millions upon millions of dollars have been spent on short-term missions. And I wonder if some of that money hadn't been spent on the missionaries and on those trying to get to the field when they can't raise the money anyway, if that wouldn't have been better used that way. Because if you take all of the groups that go around the world in a year's time in all of the various denominations and all the various schools and all the rest, I don't know how much money is spent doing it. So maybe that's a con. Also, many times, trips like that are really for the benefit of the traveler, not necessarily the benefit of the missionary. He has to host you, and that is a lot of work on his part. Then the dangers are increasing, and that's one of the things we see in our world right now where it's dangerous. As a matter of fact, I've been in parts of the world with missionaries and in places that I'd be afraid to go right now. Our missionary Tim Smith was in Istanbul, and I visited him twice in Istanbul. He had to leave because it wasn't safe to leave his family in Istanbul. I walked around like a dumb American, you know, thinking, you know, this is like the streets of Kansas City. Well, maybe safer than Kansas City, I don't know, you know, but I mean, you know, I didn't feel that fear, and all of a sudden, places like that are more dangerous than they were a few years ago. So that is there. But the bottom line, of course, is let's do it. It's missions work. And let's be smart, and let's seek God's will as we do these things. So here are, I think, some principles that we might learn from as we think about missions and trips and missionaries and how we help them and what we do as believers in these kinds of situations. So you notice on your bulletin, I have three main thoughts about this. Number one, just in verse 25, there is the trust of the church. I mean by that the trust in both the lay people who are going and the trust in the missionary that they are supporting. Now, Paul is the missionary here, you know, and though he's a unique missionary because he's an apostle, and the churches did have a special connection to the apostles, and we understand that. But he also was even financially supported by this church, and he was their missionary as well, and they were going to see him and taking care of him and doing what they could while he was there in Rome. Even though he was under house arrest, he wrote books of the Bible. He preached almost every day. He had great influence there, and he needed a lot of helpers to be with him during that time. So in verse 25, alone, you see, first of all, there was a certain need of Paul the missionary. I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus. Let me just read into that a little bit, and that is, he is sick, and since he has become sick, as we'll see in the verses following, it's better for him to go back than to stay here. It's necessary. In other words, I have things to do. And if he were of good health and helping me, it would be necessary to keep him for a while. Remember he said of Timothy up above, I want to keep him as long as I can to see what's going to happen to my trial, and then I'll let him go. But with Epaphroditus, he has to say, you know, right now it's better that he go home than stay here, because I have a need and he has a need. And so that's just the way it has. And sometimes we could be on a mission field and we could be a burden to the missionary, and we shouldn't be. And in this case, Epaphroditus was, and he knew it, and Paul knew it, and he's letting the church know that he needs to come home and get well. And he, you know, I don't have the time to do that here nor the facility, although Luke was probably there and taking care of him, but he means that. You know, in some of my stops along the way where I've been with missionaries, and all of them wonderful experiences to me, one thing that I will remember that sticks out was in Russia with my father-in-law in 92, when the door had just opened and people were going to Russia for many reasons, some taking Bibles and money and literature. And in those days, my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, Sam, and I went with them. You go with as many suitcases as you could check through, and you come home with none of them. you take everything you can take and leave it, because they had nothing. Clothes, toothpaste, chewing gum, whatever, shoes. And you just leave it with them and come home with nothing, because they had nothing. And yet in those days, there was huge interest in what was going on in the old Soviet Union and behind the Iron Curtain. And so people were going. And I remember being with Peter Romanchik. And by the way, we have his book out here on the book rack called A Path Not Lined with Roses. And we were in his church in Moscow, just outside of Moscow. This man had been in prison for 20-some years. And now he was out and he was pastoring. And his imprisonment was because he passed out Christian literature in the Soviet Union. How terrible. So he's in prison for 20 years. And we stayed with him in his home. And we preached for him. And, you know, and Dad would preach. I mean, Ann's dad. And he was Ukrainian. and Russian. He was born with those languages. He spoke broken English here, but over there, oh, he was in his field and you could tell it. And why they would have me speak, and Sam didn't speak Russian at the time very well, so he spoke through a translator at that time. And I'm thinking, don't have me speak, have him speak. What do you want to hear me for? But nope, they would have, these Americans are here. So you got three preachers, you're going to have three sermons. How would you like that, folks? We're gonna start at 10 and we're going to end at 3. Three long sermons. They expected long sermons. Well, the week before we came, there was a very famous preacher out of Atlanta who has a television program who was at that church, and he had written him and asked if he could come. And they came in the week before with all of their TV cameras and all of their crew. They came in and just basically took over the church, did their filming and all of the pastor there preaching. And as soon as the service was over, the cars were outside, packed it up, and they were gone. That had happened the week before we got there. Now, my father-in-law and Peter Romanchek were lifelong friends. So we stayed in his apartment. This was the apartment, by the way, where, you know, they expect we crazy Americans want to take a shower or a bath every day. So we're in his apartment, and he says, oh, I'll make the tub. It was a tub and a shower. I'll make it ready. Well, what he meant was he went in there, and there were minnows swimming in the bathtub. Now, the reason there were minnows swimming in the bathtub is because he was going fishing the next day, and whatever he caught on Monday was all the meat that they would eat all week long. So he's taking his bait out of the bathtub so crazy Americans can take a shower. And we're trying to tell him, no, don't do it. Oh, you know, there was no getting around it. He was going to do that for us. Anyway, in the conversations over the time we spent with him, he recalled what had happened the week before to my father-in-law. Sam was kind of translating for me, and I was listening that way. But Peter Romanchek said to my father-in-law, he said, you know, Peter, he said, we know, as a church, we know they need us more than we need them. Isn't that a sad thing? They need to make their program and their tapes and their videos and take their pictures and go back to the States and use it in their ministry more than we need them here. But there was such a need for literature and things like that, that anytime someone would come and leave Bibles or leave Sunday school literature or whatever, they were welcome to it. So I always remember that. And it stuck with me because we need to always be conscientious of the missionary. And if we're really helping him, and what can we do to help him? And so I'm just saying Epaphroditus here was conscious of it too. And he had become a burden. And he knew it, and Paul knew it. It's time to go home. That's all. And so we see that here. Secondly, we see in verse 25 the qualifications of the helper himself, that is Epaphroditus. Look at how Paul describes him. Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labor, fellow soldier, your messenger, by the way, apostolon, the word for apostle here, though he was not an apostle, those kinds of words can be used to describe other people in a non-authoritative sense. He was just a sent one, a messenger. And he that ministered, he was a minister to my wants. Those are great things. You know, here's a young man that goes and his time is cut short, but he's created such a bond with the missionary that the missionary describes him with these kinds of words. Isn't that great? That's what needs to happen and what you want to happen. And if anybody has gone to a mission field and established this kind of rapport with a missionary, for the rest of your life you feel this way toward one another, though you may only see each other now and then. It's a great thing. And so compliment Epaphroditus for being that kind of man and for Paul accepting him that way, and they become brothers with each other. There are a few men like that I know around the world, and I've brought some of them here, Ukrainian guys, because it didn't take long, but it does take a while. It doesn't happen overnight, but a few different visits, a few different ministries, and maybe difficult places you're in with somebody, you create that bond with somebody, right? And here's Paul in prison, wondering if he's even going to be released. Here's Epaphroditus becoming deathly ill, and they just get this bond with one another. and the missionary compliments him by using these terms. You know, he wasn't just another American coming with his camera. He was somebody who put himself to the work, and he knew it. Then, a third thought in verse 25 is, there also was the supply, monetarily, I think, of the church. When Paul says, he that ministered to my wants, the word wants really should be translated needs. It's not that he wanted. As a matter of fact, look with me over in chapter 4 and verse 17. He says, not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. He didn't have any wants for the church's money, in other words. If fruit could abound to that church's account, he was for it. But then notice 18, I have all and abound. I'm full, having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you. And those kinds of missionary offerings are an odor of sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. And so when you can take the missionary things that he needs, and primarily many times it is money, because that can be translated into all kinds of work on the mission field. I think one of the reasons why God has blessed this country, the United States of America, is because in its history we have distributed more wealth that God has blessed this country with on mission fields throughout the world than any other nation in history. I mean, we've taken that wealth and we've sent it there through all kinds of different means, and I think God has blessed us for it. And Paul recognizes this is fruit that abounds to your account. So the offering was a need, and when he went, Epaphroditus took it. I mean, it wasn't like wiring it today or something like that. You know, it had to be taken, and it was a dangerous journey, and you're taking money with you and that kind of stuff. And he did, and they got there with it. Okay, so number one, the trust from the church to the missionary is what we see first. Secondly, in verses 26 to 28, I label it difficulties along the way, and specifically here, it was the illness that came to Epaphroditus. So, first of all, these difficulties along the way, I'm going to try to word it like this. Foreign travel can do a few different things to us, for us, and so forth. And the first one is, I had to rethink this, but I left the wording. It can cause homesickness. Well, literally to Epaphroditus, he was sick and he needed to go home. And that's real homesickness. Sometimes it does cause homesickness. There are times when people just can't live abroad. I know that there are sometimes missionaries whose family, I mean, he could do it, but maybe she can't, or she can do it and he can't, or the kids can't, they're at a certain age or whatever. Sometimes they're just, you know, there are times when you need to be home and not here. And that happened here because of illness. So when he says here, I suppose to send to you, or let me go down to verse 26, he longed after you. He was full of heaviness. Those words mean intense feeling, distress in feeling, those two expressions. I mean, Epaphroditus did not want to go home, but he had to go home. He did not want to leave, he had to leave. And it distressed him not only that he was going to have to leave, but he had, you know, his church was going to hear and know that things didn't work out. I mean, the whole thing distressed him. So he had this desire for his home church, and yet he knew he was a burden and things needed to change. He was no longer a help, but a hindrance, and so he had to go home. So sometimes there's homesickness, if you will. Secondly, there are present dangers in the mission field and going there, difficulties along the way. In this case, it's sickness. Those of you who have been to mission fields have experienced various kinds of dangers. There's dangers in travel, of course. Just, you know, I've been on a tour bus in India where I thank the Lord that I got back safely. I never saw such driving in my life. And when I and I'll hear some missionary report or letter, some missionary that's killed in an automobile accident, and I say, I understand it. As a matter of fact, not only in Bangalore, India, in Calcutta, in Moscow, in Taipei, Taiwan, I mean, you are thankful for the law. You come home and you're thankful for speed limits and stop signs and red lights, and you know, you're thankful for it all because they have nothing. And they don't, and even when they have it, they don't pay attention to it. It's some places, it's just dangerous. So there's that kind of danger. Now we know there's terrorism and danger like that, and we pray for our missionaries and those who travel in parts of the world where you could be taken hostage, you know, all kinds of problems. With Epaphroditus, it was sickness, again in verse 26, because you had heard he had been sick, and then verse 27, indeed he was sick nigh unto death. Sickness here, asthenia, is a word that usually just means a sickness that you'll recover from. But by putting the modifier nigh unto death with it means this had progressed. We don't know what it was, what he was sick from. He almost died there in Rome. And that would have been a tragic thing. And yet that can happen too. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite stories of London and England is that when we travel over there, we go up to Bedford and see the history of John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. And that's 50 miles north of London up in Bedford. But you get to see John Bunyan's tomb in London, in Bunhill Fields, the dissenter's graveyard. It's the most prominent tomb there. And the reason is that with all that he did, the books that he wrote and the sermons that he preached when he was finally out of prison, pastoring a little church there in Bedford, he was needed sometimes just to speak to people down in London, and he would get on his horse and ride all the way to London. Well, he wasn't that well after spending 18 years in jail anyway, and so yet he was needed in London. So in stormy weather, he rode his horse all the way to London and became sick because of pneumonia-type sickness. And when he got to London, he was so sick from that trip that he died in London. And so they never could take him back to Bedford. They took him out to the dissenter's graveyard and buried him there. Isn't that sad? And so if you want to see his tomb, you have to go there. Like William Carey's buried in India, not in England either. So that kind of thing can happen. There's those present dangers. And thirdly, there's sometimes travel requires a speedy return, and that's what happened in verse 28 and so forth. So he says, I sent him therefore the more carefully. Actually, that word carefully means speedily, that when you see him again, you may rejoice, and I may be the less sorrowful too. I don't want something bad, worse to happen. It's bad enough that he's ill. Let's get him home where he can recover. May I tell you another story, just because you know him? My brother-in-law, Sam, in those days back in the 90s, he had some severe back trouble. And sometimes his back would go out and he couldn't do anything. Well, he had gone to Russia with his dad, and his back went out while he's in Russia, and he could not even get out of bed. He couldn't sit up. And he was like that for weeks. As a matter of fact, the whole time he was there. And they have terrible, in the early 90s, they had terrible medical facilities. You know, if you want to die, you go to the hospital. You know, you try anything you can to keep from doing that. They did things like heat hot rocks on the fire and put them on his back and, you know, all kinds of weird things. And what are you going to do? He's over there, and now you can't do any of the things that you had planned to do. And so what do you do? Well, my sister Deborah, whom you know, at the time worked for CNN in Atlanta in the offices. And CNN had medical people everywhere in the world to help their people if they happened to be in a situation like that. So she arranged to have Sam taken to the CNN medical people. So they did. And they evacuated him back, and you always try to carry evac insurance and so forth. Anyway, when you come back on a plane, you come back on a stretcher. You know what you have to do? They put the stretcher on the top of two seats on an airplane, so you have to buy all four seats, or six seats if it's that kind of a plane. So the stretcher goes on top. You pay for all six seats, and you come home. Plus, they don't do that unless a medical person goes with you, so they had to pay for her way as a nurse, her way also. And they brought him back to the United States that way, took him off the plane, went right to the hospital. He had back surgery, and today he's well from it. But I want to finish that story. When they were in that medical facility in Moscow, they met this nurse, and she's a Russian girl. And so Dad talks to her through the whole thing, and they're arranging all this. Well, she's flying back with him. So on the trip, if you know you didn't know my father-in-law, you should have known him. I guarantee you she heard the gospel in probably four languages. You know, whatever she spake, you know, he would give her the gospel. Well, he asked her name, of course, and she told him her name. Well, back up a little bit. When my wife and Sam were born in Argentina, when they came to the United States, they came with a suitcase, and that was it, all four of them, mom and dad and two kids. But they had to be sponsored by somebody in the States. So a Christian family that lived in New York sponsored them, and they came to New York and stayed with them for a little while and then went on to Minneapolis because he went to school up there. So here's Dad flying on this airplane with this nurse and asks what her name is, and she tells him, and he says, oh, you know, I knew some people with that same name in New York. They sponsored us, and we stayed with them, and they got to discussing that, and this girl said, those are my parents. Isn't that amazing? Those are my parents. And he's riding on that plane back with her and kind of rejoicing about all that had happened. So anyway, sometimes you just have to, you better have evacuation insurance when you go to the field, because you never know what could happen. A car accident, a heart attack, you know, whatever, something like that could and often does. So we want to be like they were and understand the difficulties along the way. Then lastly, I say they had honor that was deserved. So look at verse 29 and 30 also. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness. Hold such in reputation, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me. There's an earned reputation here. Receive him. And he says, receive such. It's kind of interesting because Timothy would be sent back also, first to Philippi and then later to Ephesus. And he did not have to go home. He was not ill. He stayed longer, and we know a lot more about Timothy than we know about Epaphroditus. And yet Paul puts him equal. You know, if you have somebody who goes to the mission field for a couple weeks and does some good work, honor that person. Thank the Lord that you can go. Thank the Lord you can have a part in them going. But if a missionary is a lifelong missionary and has given his or her whole life to the field and comes home, honor him or honor her for the rest of your life. All such that do God's work is what he's saying. There's honor deserved in that, whether a Timothy or an Epaphroditus or a Paul himself, who eventually came back also. So receive him for that matter. So there's earned reputation. There's also in verse 30, the price of self-sacrifice is seen here, and that's why honor is deserved, is actually in the second part of the verse. Not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me. Number one, he didn't regard his life. Number two, he was doing something the church couldn't do. You know, missionaries go to the field and they do what we can't do. We can support, we have that part, but our hands aren't there, our feet aren't there. They are for us. Paul knew that, the church knew that, Epaphroditus knew that, and Paul points that out. And he says it was because of this work that he put his own life at risk, after all. And when somebody puts their own life at risk, then honor that person. I know I've told family stories, but I got to tell you this one too. One time, when later in his ministry, Ann's dad, he had congestive heart failure. So his heart was not working well. It operated like on 20% capacity. But he didn't want to stay home. And he had to take those kind of pills, you know, that keep the water from swelling up inside you, and it discharges the water. Well, if you're on those, you know that you better not be too far from a bathroom either. I mean, that's just part of it goes on. Well, Dad, when you go to Russia, there are no bathrooms, no nothing. And so he knew that and what a difficulty that creates. So he quit taking those pills because he didn't want to have that inconvenience while he's trying to minister. And I remember the days. There's a picture in that book over there, that his autobiography that we sell. He's standing on a corner holding up tracts, and people are running to get them. That's the way it was in those days. And he didn't want to distract from any of that. So here he has congestive heart failure. His heart's operating at 20%, and he quits taking his pills so he won't be a distraction on the mission field. Well, a good friend of mine, Don Cox, who was a pastor in the States, went with him. Don got pneumonia while he was there. So here's Don taking care of Peter, but he's got pneumonia. Peter's not taking his pills. And they did the whole thing and came home. And when they landed in Indianapolis, we went to pick them up, and they're wheeling two of them off the plane in wheelchairs. And here's Dad with his legs about this big around, swollen all up. And here's Don, emaciated from having pneumonia. And the two biggest smiles you ever saw on two people's face. They put their lives at risk for the gospel's sake. And I don't know what Epaphroditus was sick from, but he was willing to die if that was necessary. But no, let's get him home. And to this day, it's better off for a missionary to get the help that he needs. And then one last thought, and that is right in the beginning of verse 30. Because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death. We need to remember, honor is gained simply, folks, not because it's your work, but because it's the Lord's work. And I think every missionary knows this, knows it better than we do. They've given up a lot. They've given up a life in the United States. They've given up comfortable living sometimes. And they are doing the Lord's work, and that's why. If it were just, I think for just their honor, they wouldn't do it. But it's for the honor of Christ. It's for what he has given us. So it's for the work of Christ. So let me leave these thoughts in your head. Consider the Lord's omniscience just for a minute. Of all the attributes we could consider, just consider his omniscience, meaning his all-knowing. First of all, he holds all things together by the word of his power. Jesus Christ holds every atom that moves in this universe together by the word of his power. It's his work. He knows the number of hairs on your head. Now, why does he bother to do that? Some of you are a lot more bothered than the rest of us. And why would he bother? Why does God want to know the number of hairs on your head? Because he's omniscient. And nothing goes beyond his notice. Why does he care when a sparrow falls to the ground and God sees it and cares over a sparrow that falls to the ground? Because he's omniscient. God knows your thoughts, much less your words. He knows every thought that goes through your head. And he knows all of these things, past, present, and future, all at once. I'm only trying to emphasize that when we enter into the work of the Lord, we're just one small link in a big chain, in a long chain, in a complicated chain, if you will. And there's been a lot that he has done before us, and we link onto that, and when we're done, there will be a lot done after us. It's all the Lord's work. As Paul said, one man plants, another waters. Of course, it's God that gives the increase. So when we understand things that way, we understand even when Paul said, you know, that we are the called according to his purpose. All things work together for good to them who love God, who are the called according to his purpose. We just enter into all of this in some small, minute way. And who are we then to say, look what I did? When every thought and every atom and every result is because of his mercy and grace. Paul knew that. Epaphroditus knew that. I think the Philippian church knew that. We should know that. My favorite mission song in our songbook is O Zion Haste, my favorite missionary song. And the last verse of that song goes like this: give of thy sons to bear the message glorious. Give of thy wealth to speed them on their way. Pour out thy soul for them in prayer victorious, and all thou spendest, Jesus will repay. Publish glad tidings, tidings of peace, tidings of Jesus, redemption and release. That's why we do it. That's why Epaphroditus did it. That's why Paul did it. And we can learn some things from looking at these two great men. And I hope that we have. Stand with me now, if you will. As we come to the close, let's go to the Lord in prayer and bow our heads and ask Him to search our hearts and encourage us in what we've heard today. Father, how we thank You for missionary work, for taking the Great Commission seriously, for great men and women, children and adults, who have given their lives to serve You here and around the world. I thank You for them, Father. Thank You for camaraderie that is built, brotherhood that is built over the years with these people. Thank You that we can enter into their ministry by giving of our wealth to speed them on their way. Thank You that we can give of our sons to spread the message glorious. And Father, we know in the end You will repay. And so, Father, encourage our hearts. Help us, Father, to have a longing, a sense for ministry like this. Help us even where we can, as a church and as individuals, to enter into that ministry in every way that we can. I pray, Father, that You'd be glorified by it, and through us, through this church, through Your people, many great things might be done this way until Jesus comes. We'll thank You for that. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.